information. But basically, what we say about community philanthropy, well, as you know, philanthropy is basically a Greek word that says love of humanity. And charity is more welfare driven, and with charity we sort of are always ready to give somebody a fish so that they can cook dinner. But I think philanthropy, just to make the distinction, what philanthropy does is that we enable somebody to actually get the fish or catch the fish itself on an ongoing basis. And the way Global Fund for Community Foundation has not defined but actually built some parameter around that word is that we look at resource and we look at assets and we look at trust as inevitable ingredients needed for community philanthropy. And of course, community philanthropy is grounded in the community and it's also driven by the community. So we have a very interesting situation in Nepal. I mean, I have not been in touch with directly with aid agencies in the last almost 20 years, more than 20 years, but I worked for aid agencies for a while here. And that gave me a personal insight into how, because of the structures many of them go through, and how those structures have gone on forever then and changing contexts, and how we haven't really looked at seeing what needs to be changed, what needs to be transformed with ongoing times. It's a it becomes a very hierarchical and often a very redundant structure, and that's actually why, I mean, when I was widowed, I needed to work for money because I had three children going to school, and I did that, but it really just didn't work for me. When I felt I was not giving the most that I could, and the other, I just felt that I was a part of a problem rather than a solution, and so I quit those structures. And all it requires, I think, is there are good people everywhere and good intentioned people, but sometimes intentions are not enough, I've learned. Because when you see that something is really inappropriate, then to expect good work from that structure becomes very difficult. So I'm saying, in terms of community philanthropy, there's a whole lot of funds and foundations that are emerging. In my own experience, the women's funds, the first one that's recorded, I think, was Mama Cash in Holland, and then 5 years later, the Global Fund for Women started in Palo Alto, now San Francisco. And then led by some of these, and then a few others like Philia and in Germany. And then a whole lot of women's funds began with a network of the women's funds meeting, the first one, which took place here in 2000. So it's a very historical thing. And at that time, there were a couple of women's funds who are planning to take off, like the We Trust in Africa and African Women's Development Fund, Nirnaya in Hyderabad, Angela Borba in Mexico. So about 7-8 of us came around the table. And then when they were in Tewa's premise, although we were still in a rented space at that time, But when they heard of what we were doing, everyone said, if you can do this in a country like Nepal, then we can do it. And so now I think there are about 40 women's funds. So environmental funds, women's funds, the women's funds are now called Prospera. So if you Google them also, you will see, you'll be very updated on it rather than me. And then the environmental funds and indigenous funds and all kinds of, as for me, I think one, they happened because, the, or they grew in numbers because of local felt needs, either because the conditions were instable, insecure, governments were becoming more and more redundant in some places, and so all we need, there were emerging needs, we needed to resource ourselves for what we wanted, because whatever was human rights or you know, whatever needs women had, or what did women's empowerment mean, and so how could we get little funds that could resource these activities or these campaigns? And I think this is how they all have been going out of the world. And because of that, I think it's the right time, or it's pertinent to question what then is a fund, a community fund, because all of these can be community funds. And certainly Tewa is a community fund, and I was telling Jenny how the women's funds need to feel their yes. They come with very strong feminist agendas and politics, but they are also community funds, and they don't have to be just women's funds, they can be also community funds. And so I think that recently they had a meeting in Sri Lanka, the Asian fund, women's funds coming with Prospera, and I think they were talking more broadly, because I know Jenny was invited there too. And so Tewa is began as a women's fund because of very strong feminist politics that I had. Because in Nepal, what was happening was in 1990, and of course most of these things that are organic and driven by the community is grounded in its own realities or context. And since 1990, big political changes began to happen in Nepal. We began Tewa in 1995, September. And what I was seeing then was women, a group of women, if they came into the UNDP, where I was located for the then UN Women, UNIFEM at that time, and they came for money. These were all bilateral funds, so they were tied up with the government, and nobody was even willing to meet with them, so they would just have to go back. And they were basically looking for small funds and, you know, small support for an income generation activity or capacity building training. So I used to, even at that time, I had the luxury, and I knew because of my own participation on the board of the Global Fund for Women, and later on we founded the Urgent Action Fund, which was more time urgent, learning from the Global Fund for Women. So I would connect them to the Global Fund for Women. But many of them didn't even know how to write these proposals in English. Now we can write proposals in Nepali to the Global Fund for Women. But at that time, we were still evolving and we were not. So basically, my idea to begin Tewa Lee, one on that, how to resource women who were organizing all over Nepal but who had no access to resource. The other, very personal, because for feminists, the personal becomes very political. And for me too, what I did was when my husband died, we needed to do this very strange and dehumanizing practice for widows, grounded in religion and cultural tradition. And I did that for a year. I did a very severe, like, you don't go out of the house, you wear only white, you eat only pure food cooked by your Brahmin lady, if you have the luxury to have one, or cooked by yourself. And I did that for a whole year, but after the year I did nothing. That means the animal death rituals that you need to do twice to honor your dead. I mean, I just did nothing. And which was a little radical, which meant some ostracization and some self-elimination, but not doing that, it made me wonder how Nepal's philanthropy was very much along religious and cultural traditions. And actually very old practices of philanthropy exist here. I mean, like in most of our religious texts, how tithing becomes such an important part. Here too, in a different way, you did these, through these practices, you gave always back to the community. However it could have been, like within your own radius of family, friends, neighbors, community, and your spiritual or your religious sect. So it made me wonder how I was giving back to the society, and not doing all these practices meant that I wasn't really, and unless I began to instill that practice in the younger generation and also practiced it myself, that I wouldn't really be sustaining. I mean, I'm responsible then where the community goes. So I felt that very important that I practice my own philanthropy, and I learn my own philanthropy. And in doing that, I knew there were a lot of people who were increasingly urbanizing, increasingly modernizing, globalizing, and therefore it's becoming more and more difficult for people to do these and maintain these traditional practices. So we needed to give something back tangibly for somebody's health or education or community advancement, and that's basically what we did. So in Tewa, we began to raise money from individuals, which was, I think, the most important part. I chose, in fact, not to go to aid agencies to raise money, because I felt by the time, in a year, I meant to hand over leadership in 5 years, that's the time, because within this whole development scene in Nepal, which had become really, God help us, where we have landed now, but I saw that we were not really touching the lives of people we wanted to change in meaningful ways, because we couldn't be as sincere as we intended to be. And so the whole idea was, how then could we raise money from Nepalis? And so I chose not to raise money from aid agencies, which are all around here, because one, the process would be very bureaucratic, and there would be not much chance I would get it, because I haven't aligned myself to one or the political party. And everything in Nepal has been very, very politically centralized. And so it's either the left or the right, and if you don't belong anywhere, then nobody knows who you are and what you do, and are not interested also. So we began to raise money. We were very lucky because we had all these small women's funds and feminist donors who were within my network already. So I was assured of very small, not so small for Nepal, small grants, like at the most $20,000 per year. And we ran a very frugal organization for the initial years, and we raised money. And every penny we raised, we gave in grants from the first year. So I remember first year we made 9 grants, and we raised about 350,000 rupees. And following years we did better, and we managed to raise about, I think now we raise anything from 25 to 30 lakhs of Nepali rupees, which is 100,000, and or $25,000 or so. And that every penny of that goes out to women's groups all over Nepal. And I think we've given out almost 600 grants in most of our districts, like 69 districts out of. And some of them, there are some upper mountains, and there's not much organizing of women's groups. So you can see pretty much all over Nepal now, so as they come to us. So this we've carried on, and we did that in many interesting ways, but one of them was, for instance, early on, I chose to bring together a group of volunteers, as we so said, and we bind them morally for 3 months, and they would be asked to promote Tewa and Tewa's philosophy, as well as try and raise money from their immediate circles of family and friends. Because women did not have that, the articulation of development work for them to argue and go to big houses and organizations. So if they stayed within their own community, and therefore community philanthropy, I think was very much, it was community philanthropy. Because it was really going to your own parents, to your sisters, brothers, uncles, whoever had trust in you. Because without trust, how would they trust Tewa? In the initial years, Tewa was not even a name. So, and there was a huge mistrust for organization. If you were into NGO or development work, people said dollar farming businesses. So you were doing dollar farming businesses. And so many of our volunteers met with that, but we kept doing this. And what happened in that process is the volunteers, who were primarily in those days women who were homemakers and who had lost self-confidence and who had lost touch with the outer domain. So they, in that coming together, they regained, their children were grown up, their husbands were doing better, but they had no confidence to. So they regained their confidence, and they also helped raise money for Tewa, and sometimes significantly, sometimes in small amounts, but they became involved in all the other fundraising events we did. So we had support to do, or like we'd have a walkathon, that whole organizing of it would be done by them. We would have lighting lamps, garage sales, raffles. I mean, so it would go all over, and there would be one their participation in the events and in supporting all these fundraising activities. And on the other hand, they themselves made friends, got back their confidence, went back to colleges, started little enterprises, and so it became a very mutually satisfying kind of. So this is how we, I think, still continue to raise money. And one of the ways, I mean, that is, that has been very, very helpful for us. And in Taiwan, now that you are located here, you've seen that there's, I don't know if you've seen the monument that is on the retaining wall down here with two snake goddesses. And so if you look at that closely, you will see that that was one of the fundraising campaigns we did for, or I initiated, for finishing the whole complex. Not the whole complex, except the last building. And Anandi 1, Anandi 2, and most of this section of landscaping and what we finished with that. And we intended to raise about $900,000, and we did manage to raise $1 million because we had one very wonderful donor who, it's really a very wonderful, I don't know if I'm just running away, so I want to stop and ask you if this is too boring or... And please ask me to stop if you have a question or... So anyway, this person had come to Tewa a couple of years back because they was funding something here earlier. But other than that, we didn't know who they were, and we had very little touch. And so one day, suddenly early in the morning, just as we were closing the campaign, and I had managed to raise a little over $700,000, and I was saying, okay, this is Nepal, I mean, that's not bad, we raised a pretty good amount. And so I get this call in the morning, and so Patrick's based in Singapore, says, you know, I've been really following, I used to write this monthly update that I put out on the internet, and I've been following up all your progress, and I know that you only have a few days left for your closing function. And I was in deep depression, and so have not been able to say much, but I just came out of it as a few days back. So I just want to gift you $300,000. And I was saying, no, we need only $200,000. And he was saying, no, take it, because we want you to be comfortable in this. And so, you know, we really, at that nick of time after, but what that allowed, because it happened so at the nick of time, what that allowed us to do is that Radhika, who took your pictures, everybody here has made a contribution to that. And the way we said was Nepalis give 100,000 rupees, but staff give 25,000 rupees, and support staff give 10,000 rupees, and it'll be taken out from their salaries on a monthly basis. And my convincing them was saying, tomorrow when your children, grandchildren come and visit this place, they are not going to say my father was a gardener or my mother was a homemaker. They are going to say my father or my mother was a donor to Devaraya, they will learn to give. And so this is how everybody gave money. Even staff who had left us, they came back. And then the grantees, as many as we could reach personally, because you know you can't do this with the letters, and in Nepal letters are tricky, and not everybody has access to internet. So even over 100 grantees, we haven't managed to write all their names, but over 100 grantees gave us money, small amounts of money, 10,000, 5,000, 3,000, 2,000, but still they've given us money in that. So because we were trying to see how we can get money from everywhere, we took that extra trouble to talk, have to take the time to talk within our own family of this organization, and managed to raise money from everyone, really. And so that's how we managed to. So just now we just finished the third residential building this March, and we had a opening 19th of September, and we did another fundraising, and we haven't been that successful. We probably needed about 400,000, but we've raised a little over 250 for that, and it's still ongoing. We're still keeping our ears open. I think I'll add just one thing and then I'll stop, so if you have questions. The other thing is that during the earthquake, what enabled us to have a really insightful and direct look into how philanthropy can even be practiced in times of disaster is that we had taken money, we took money to the community, to the affected community. We had over 120 outreach to communities who were connected to Teva, like granting groups or volunteers connection or youth groups of Nagari Gavas. And every day we used to go to two or three of these places, and it took a whole long, so there were two or three different groups who were being mobilized, and we mobilized our own family or friends. I mean, no extra money for anything like we did. It was, and we took money, so not tins and food, which would have required huge logistical planning. But we said people know how what they need, and they know. So we gave them 10,000 rupees. So because the government was very slow in their outreach, we just took money, and you will be interested. I mean, it was very successful. People stayed in line for the whole day, very decently, without any grumble, without any, and trying to support us, saying, oh, we can't even give you tea, and feeling bad about that. And then, so as we distributed, finally, I think it was my third visit or so, and I said, let's try, let's ask, because they're not different from us. I mean, if disaster strikes us, we're going to be a little in shock, we're going to be a little sad, but we are not going to lose our humanity or our humaneness. Or so we are, so I asked them, you know, if you don't mind, I mean, would you mind contributing a little bit back so that we can either bring it back to you or either take it to the other communities that we go? And it was just unanimous. They all said, of course, this we've been doing all our life. So here, take, everybody gave 100 rupees back. Now 100 rupees is not much when you look at, but when you go to communities after communities, and it is their sense of giving, which I felt was so important for them, that they could do that and feel good about it. and that it could be done. So I think some of these experiences in community philanthropy. But without trust and without building relationships, I think it's very difficult to sustain and nurture community philanthropy. I'll stop here and then probably want to put it.
So,
maybe my question is very stupid. You say you provide a grant to the government to establish it. Have you been working on a loan?
No.
In NY?
We make grants because there's a lot of savings and credit groups here. And it's a whole different skill set, which we don't have, which I didn't have, for instance. And linking most of the women's groups we make grants to are already linked with credit groups. If not, we can always link them if they so desire. But when we make grants, it is with the flexibility they can use it, and sometimes women's visibility and voice is very much undermined because they can't put a signboard out or they haven't been able to do an event that makes them visible in their community. And that's very, very important. Or they want a leadership training or a legal training, and that's extremely important. So if we give it for women's felt needs, we also assume that they know what they need most, and it's not for us to think that we... So if they want to do saving and credit, which many of them have also done, revolving funds or savings and credit, they are most welcome to do that.
My name is Happy. I'm from Indonesia. My organization, Siakup Emergency Unit, we also got funding from one of our donors to establish a guest house and training center, so that we could have a fundraising media, so that when there is no project, we could get income from this guest house and training center. But we didn't do the community philanthropy. So this guest house and training center, we provide trainings to other NGOs, governments, and then some of the profits goes to the community where the guest house can be a emergency evacuation center during the disaster, and also we give training to the community nearby. But we never did this to this community philanthropy. And what I want to ask you is whether when you do the fundraising from the community, is that from the community that has been assisted by Dewa, or also new community, how is it a one time philanthropy, or it's like continuous like what other organizations did in Indonesia? So small amount with many communities, but it's like a monthly or annual basis.
Well, this is on annual basis, and it's a grant. So initially when we started, we gave only 50,000 rupees or less. Now our grant size has increased to be 300,000 rupees. And we can give repeat grants if we know somebody is doing very well, and so for 3 times at least, we sometimes make that provision to give grants, and we raise money sometimes by selling raffles when we do this kind of, there's another place where for the 16 days of violence, they're collecting 1 rupee a day for 18 days. So those kind of things, the grantees get involved and they give money. And like here, when we solicited for this building, some of the grantees gave money. But mostly we raise money from here, where we are located in Kathmandu, from our own families. And so it's a way of allowing us to practice our philanthropy and learning how to practice philanthropy. Because when you give through religious and cultural traditions, like everybody puts tikka, and then all the children, little children get money, all the sisters and their husbands get money. I don't know, there's a certain system for that. But when we don't give something directly, then we think we don't have to give for anything. So it's a way of creating a habit also, habituating people to give. To give for a cause.
Just to add to our question, so how do you identify the community in need? Like, how do you know that this community is in need? Or is, so what is the like, criteria or the process?
It's a very big process, but a very respectful one. So now they know about us through word of mouth.
Yes.
And earlier there was some, I know at least one group, Prisma Tharu Singh, I don't even know, Mahila Uthan Kendra in Bardia. They had huge donors. And when she took a grant from us, she used to say, Didi, like, I take this grant not for money, because I have thousands of dollars coming in from Asia Foundation and UNICEF and all these donors. But I take it because of the way it's given, with so much respect and by making a connection, so that kind of a thing. And there's a process, so now they can also download these application forms. It's in Nepali, they fill a simple form. Then Tewa does a lot of checking in through local government, like LDO, Women's Development Division. Or LDOs, or so at the local level, or through different organizations that we may know of, both international or Nepalese. And then we also try and, as far as possible, invite them to have a conversation with us. More importantly, rather than checking on them, we want to tell them how we have raised the money and why. So we want to make that very clear to them. This is not given to us a huge sum of money by some aid agencies. We've raised every penny from Nepalese, and Nepalese who can give little and little more. And so Tyuso Goripachi, they use it, I mean, better than we could expect. And usually, that's very important, telling them how we raise the money and what it is for. And there's a lot of due diligence that is done by the staff. So there's an external committee who approves, who are development practitioners, so who understand the context, gender, development. And then it goes finally, first the staff does the shortlisting and all the check-ins. Then the committee meets. The committee does the second round and more or less finalizes and shortlists the grants. And then the board just, for legal validation, they just approve. It's a very thorough process.
You mentioned that many women, for various reasons, have little self-confidence in the situations they're in. And you talked about providing these grants. Do you see what effect those grants have on the attitudes of the people who receive them at all? And if so, what do you see?
Oh, it's really amazing. I mean, as far as I was here directly working with it, I saw some, but I have been engaged in development for a long time. But my colleagues now will be able to tell you more, like recently, what's happened. One, I think the value of that money is so much more for them. Then, because of the way we've raised it, now whoever comes to this premise, we try and hold as much meetings as we can here. Initially, we would go out so that they can see for themselves, and it raises the bar for them. And then their confidence, their self-respect, and most of them have connected with larger support simply because they hold our, and that gives them some credibility and some visibility in the local areas. But their love for the grants that they have received is really a lot of respect.
And then, is there any instances of the cases that the grant is not properly utilized or something like that?
Maybe, yes. Maybe one or two in 99, one or two we have found, but we have hardly ever. We do appraisal visits to the extent we can, which is not much. I think about maybe 20%. Appraisal visits and maybe about 30% monitoring. There's a monitoring and learning evaluation section here. So there's a wonderful report that we should give it to you, the element. And so I'll ask Deepak to bring it to you tomorrow, Terry, so that you can share it with you. Any of you anywhere. So they do some of that monitoring and evaluation. And then usually by the way they come out, I mean, it's unbelievable. So yeah.
I've got one more question, which is that I know that you are also on the board of the Global Fund for Community Foundations, and so you see a broader perspective on what's going on. To what extent has the idea of community philanthropy spread both geographically and in terms of different applications? Because you've emphasised your concern for sort of concern for the feminist movement and for the needs of women, but you know, what do you see as you work more broadly with GFCF?
Initially, I think it was when the Global Fund for Community Foundation was being born, to share with you openly and transparently. Before, just as I came into the board, both the World Bank and USAID had an interest in some. For some reason, it fell through, and I don't think I would have stayed on if it had gone in that direction. But so the 10 years has been an amazing time where, with a very small team of people, there's been a lot of collaboration and a lot of researching, and I think the time is right to ask this question, because with all the other funds that are growing, the women's funds, all the other funds, more and more we are realizing that at least development aid has not delivered in the way we expected it to, and it's not going the right way. So I think that, and then the mushrooming of all these other, I think big philanthropic organizations are also called to look into their own acts and how they now deliver. And maybe there's a better possibility for more community foundations to be on the rise and to meet up to all these challenges that are emerging in the world, and to be locally owned, to be locally, if there's no ownership at the local level, how do we expect anything to be sustainable? So, yes.
I'm just intrigued. Tell me a bit more about why you're so glad that the possible deal with the World Bank and USAID fell through.
No, because I don't believe in those big structures. I think they are redundant in our world. But that's a very brazen. I worked within some of the aid structures, and as I said, I think many good people become very trapped in thinking that, well, but how can you have structures that cannot be sustained, run, or do good? You know, that the structures themselves cannot be sustained out of their things, so it's unlikely that they are going to sustain other. Maybe they need to look into their own structures.
So, a follow-up question. So, one of the what would be typically a grant-receiving organization be
criterias?
Because we see a lot of local organizations being one person driven, so how do you define?
All of those fears are there, but these are especially the women's organizations.
Okay.
They have to be managed and led by women, with a large membership of women. I mean, if there are one or two men there, like in remote far western Nepal and all, sometimes they need men just to do their courier work or to translate because they don't understand English. So there are one or two members, but largely, then they have to be registered locally.
Okay.
So they have to submit their audit reports to the government. Even despite all these, we can find that they are either politically driven or motivated, or there's no harm in that if they deliver, but sometimes it can be with much less. Among women's organization, their learning development, their comprehension of development and the politics of development and how and what they are doing in that context is difficult. But they are very well intentioned, largely I say. Some of them are very, very smart, of course. But largely they are very, very well intentioned. They want to improve the quality of their lives and their lesser sisters. So they are not busy, they are into bee farming, they are into vegetable farming, they are into goat keeping, sewing, training, and they are very much into revolving funds. Not the credit, but the revolving funds, mostly among themselves. So they give out how many goats once, and then it goes again to another group with 10 people, and that way they, so in doing that, they are building their own constituencies as women who are better empowered, who have better political voice and standing, And these are the kind of groups who are actually, and a lot of advocacy work, because the state is very weak, so whenever the violence against women, or even in the communities, like when men drink and beat a woman, then the others can organize to protest that, and it can be resolved at the community level.
I mean, what we find with most aid organizations, maybe it's their comfort zone, is that, you know, the more local you get, the more dynamic the situation is. You know, basically you said there are sides that people take. There could be other local dynamics. In our society, you know, caste is a huge thing, and, you know, exclusion. So, I mean, it must be very difficult for you to navigate through all these local structures to be able to find real, genuinely intention.
You come to Teva now. I mean, I cannot answer because I have not looked at Teva's grant making personally in the last, how many years now, 17 years or so. But they come to Teva.
Mm-hmm.
They either send proposals. If they are coming to Kathmandu, they are for sure to visit because they've heard about it. So now they come to us, and then there's a lot of conversation that goes on the phone. Luckily, the phone has been a very big connector, and it's much easier now than it used to be. Otherwise, the remoteness and the geography and communications difficulties of Nepal made it very difficult in the earlier days.
Yeah.
I think we are just,
Johnny? We have more questions. I would like to thank you on behalf of all of us here. Terror and where you came from to arrive in doing this. I think it's very interesting. I've had more experience looking at loans for activities. We particularly looked at loans for house strengthening. So this is a model which is also very interesting. So from me, thank you very much for sharing with us.
Thank you. Have a wonderful rest of the meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your bag?
Yeah, it's outside there.
It's there.
Directly to Tiwa, and Mr. Nirjan will be here at our tea break tomorrow in the afternoon to collect those supplements. If any of you are not sure where you stand, come and see me and I'll try and help you. And if, in principle, the payments are to be made in US dollars, a again, if that's a problem, come and see me. We'll try and sort that out.